Larry yesterday took us through a look at the creation theology of the Bible. And I guess I want to pick up at that point and talk about what some of the implications are for us of that sort of theology, that view of the earth as the Lord's, we are its stewards, for the way we as comfortable, economically comfortable people live in the time to come. If those of you who heard some of it last week will forgive me and be patient with me, I'd like to refer again to an Irma Bombeck column, which deals in a kind of frivolous but with serious point way with our tendency to add gadgets, gimmicks, which use electricity, to add them endlessly to our style of life. She says, for a country facing an energy crisis, we've certainly become appliance junkies. I met a couple last summer who had an electric coffee maker, blankets that plugged in, can openers, ice makers, mixers, hair dryers, a donut maker, hamburger fryer, crepe maker, food slicer, knife sharpener, slow cooker, electric toothbrush, electric broom, hot curlers, and an electric wok. And they were camping. A friend bought one of those machines that dices, slices, purees, chops, slivers, mixes, and matches. Everything but opens the mail. She's worried. Her husband is beginning to have feelings for it. It boggles the mind to predict what is in the future to satisfy the needs of appliance junkies. It's my guess that we can look for electric dental floss for people who can be putting on their socks and saving time. An automatic page turner for people who read in bed and their arms get cold when they're outside the covers. An electric car jack with an extension cord you wouldn't believe. An automatic defroster for glasses when you're cooking and steam escapes when you take the lid off the pan. An electric cooler to blow your soup while you talk with your dinner partner. Don't laugh. I bet it's only a matter of time before someone has a digital sign over their stove that tells how many kilowatts are being used per second. So, where do we begin? I want to look at the simple living movement this morning and point out some of its weaknesses as well as strengths. I've really got, I guess, four parts. One is to look at the biblical witness on materialism, on material consumption. A second part is to suggest that there may be a new value base emerging in our culture, our North Atlantic or Western culture, with regard to consumption that has some biblical roots perhaps for some people, but is also a secular set of values that are emerging, and which I find kind of heartening. Third, to look at the voluntary simplicity movement. There is a movement that is discernible, that is usually called voluntary simplicity or simpler living. What does it mean? Where is it going? And how much do we read into it? And finally, some challenges to the church out of all of this. Let me begin then with Christianity as a materialist faith. It certainly is not a denial of the material. Christianity, the incarnation itself, is an affirming of materiality, of the enfleshing of God, in fact. That's what the incarnation is about. Christianity has never had as one of its goals to escape into some spiritual existence or spiritual form, shucking off the material. We confess faith in the resurrection of the body and believe in a new heaven and a new earth. I'm not sure what that means, but at least it seems to mean that there will be a material existence even after death. And materiality is good, not bad, as in some other religions it is viewed. God's will for us then is not to do without material blessings or material good. It is neither poverty nor extravagance that God wills for us, but sufficiency. Seems to me that's the biblical witness. And that is certainly the theme of John Taylor's book. Excess, waste, extravagance, superfluous consumption when some don't have basic needs met. That's the message of this book, and Taylor claims of the Bible. I think he's right. We haven't paid a lot of attention to that in the past because the common history of most human beings, as Larry said yesterday, has been survival, poverty, the struggle to have enough. Well, some of us, rich Christians in a poor world today, have attained that level of having enough. Now what? Now what is God's word for us? Proverbs 38 and 9 is a kind of a clue. It's, you know, it's not the central message of the whole Bible in this verse. It is a word from a devout person speaking to God in the wisdom literature. And that person says, God, give me neither riches nor poverty. Because if I think I better read it in the... This is the Jerusalem Bible. It gives reasons why both extremes are to be shunned. It's Proverbs chapter 30, verses 8 and 9. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Grant me only my share of bread to eat, for fear that surrounded by plenty, I should fall away and say, Yahweh, who is Yahweh? Or else, in destitution, take to stealing, and thus profane the name of my God. Either way, there's a danger. Give me a middle road. Enough. Sufficiency. Moderation. So enough is the key word. Gandhi once said, I don't know if he was referring to the present global dilemma or just thinking of India at that time, but I think it applies universally. He said, there is enough for everyone's need, but not for everyone's greed. Well, that's a neat little saying, but it still doesn't tell you where needs and greeds diverge, you know, because we have a tendency, the richer we get, to define upward continually our needs. Last year's wants or greed become this year's needs. And we see it in our children, if not in ourselves. Every Christmas season or pre-Christmas season, there's a new list of wants that our kids have had, especially when they were younger, a new list of wants that become needs. I need that because it's available. A few years ago, it was the computer television game which came out. And the only issue ethically for the kids, as we debated whether or not to get it, they wanted it because their friends had it, and they saw it advertised, and it was neat, cool, the latest thing. The only issue for them was, can we afford it? And we said, yeah, we can probably afford it. We've got the cash to acquire it if we want it. We can go into debt and acquire it if we want it. That's the way we do with other things. They didn't raise the question of whether we needed it. And I think that's true for adults as well. Our wants tend to become our needs. I've asked groups when I wasn't talking on an announced subject that had to do with simpler living or restraint in consumption, I've asked groups when they felt they would be rich enough or have enough. And invariably, if groups aren't tipped off about the subject matter you're going to be dealing with, invariably people will say, in all honesty, when I have a little more than I have now. At whatever level of income you are, it takes just a little more than what you have now. You've probably experienced a sizable increase in income at some point and seen how immediately it was all consumed. It was used up, either through a backlog or a new list of items that you had to acquire. I think that's the common experience of most Americans. So most Americans, therefore, don't feel rich at all. It's a relative term. Rich in comparison to whom? The biblical word is that there are limits. There are clues throughout the Bible if you look for them. I think even the story of the garden fall and the forbidden tree, the first sin of humankind, in one sense was a refusal to accept God's no as an answer, a refusal to accept any kind of limits. We had all of the fruit of the garden save the fruit of one tree. But that wasn't enough. We had to have all, period, including the fruit of the forbidden tree. One of the most delightful illustrations from biblical history of this theme of sufficiency is the manna story. You remember how God fed his people in the wilderness, and in so many words it says there was enough for everyone, regardless of their need. If you had a larger need, you got more. You could take more. If you had a smaller need, less was sufficient. The only thing that was not permitted was what?
Hoarding.
Storing up more than you needed. Don't you have faith that God will provide manna again tomorrow? So what happened if you stored up more than you needed? It rotted, it spoiled, it stank, it fermented or something, we don't know, but it was not usable. I think that's saying to us in our culture that there is no divine right to a doggy bag. We live in a kind of not only a throwaway culture, but a doggy bag culture, where portions are much too large, so we have to have a doggy bag to avoid wasting. We carry home the excess in a doggy bag. There's another way to go, and that is to take smaller portions. Some restaurants now are doing that, by the way, under pressure from customers. They are offering two choices, two sizes of portion. You usually don't save a whole lot because most of the cost of a restaurant is in labor, not in the food itself. But there are some where you get a dollar less for a smaller portion. The laws of gleaning in the Old Testament said, don't have your harvesters so efficient that they take every last kernel. Leave some behind. Enough is enough. Leave some for those who depend on that, on the gleanings, for their own survival. The poor, the strangers and sojourners, the orphans and widows. Ruth depended on that with her mother-in-law after she was husbandless. The law of limited cropping. A lot of good, we would say, soil conservation measures practiced in the Old Testament. The law of first fruits. Or if you take a bird in its nest, don't take both the mother and the young bird. Leave one of them behind as kind of seed for the future, for the next generation of birds. The first and best fruits were to be given to God, not because God needed them, but because that's society's way of meeting needs of other human beings. It was like a tax, but it wasn't from the bottom, it was from the top. It was off the top. It was the cream of the crop. Sabbath, don't work 7 days a week. 6 days is enough to acquire, to earn, to produce. Rest on the seventh day, partly because your oxen need a rest. And the year of Jubilee, which was the Sabbath seven times, seven Sabbath years times seven plus one, was the year of Jubilee. And there were all sorts of provisions for the renewal of the people, of the earth, the release of captives, the forgiveness of debts, a fresh start. In the New Testament, the parable of the late workers in the field, very offensive to those who worked the full day and then all got the same wage. What is significant about that in this connection is that all who worked, including those who worked only an hour or two, got enough for one day's pay. What they got was one day's wage. All received enough. Parable about grace, also I think related to the idea of sufficiency. Bigger barns do not satisfy the man who builds bigger barns. The abundance of life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. It doesn't say that possessions are evil in themselves. It's a word about abundance and putting security in quantity of acquisition. So a biblical theology of stewardship evolves out of that and other material, some of which we talked about yesterday. Caretaking of the earth, that's what stewardship is to be done with the needs of everyone, including future generations, in mind. Not just our time, but those who come after us. I remember farmers in rural Iowa when I was growing up who were very conscious of that. I suspect farmers still are. I don't know. I've heard tell of some farmers in recent times who are not so concerned about stewardship of the earth for future generations, are doing more mining of the earth than farming of it. There's a problem with the water table in western Nebraska where they've been using center pivot irrigation. Any of you familiar with that? Huge center pivot. They form big circles. You fly over it and you see these big circles of green. They are getting crops out of sandy soil, which traditionally did not bear crops, but they're doing it at great expense. The water table is going down perceptibly, year by year, and there's some concern that has to end. Well, you know, what does stewardship call for in that kind of situation? And with concern for the future generations. Stewardship also means careful taking. Caretaking of the earth, but also careful taking from the earth on my part. I think not meeting frivolous needs until the basic needs of others are met. Again, that's a principle. We can debate where that line should be. God's covenant with us then is bountiful. It is full of bounty, but it is not limitless in material blessings. We're to manage the wealth-producing capability of the ecosystem to meet the needs of all earthlings. We are not to manage it for selfish aggrandizement. That's the bargain. There is enough, but not a superabundance for the few. St. Ambrose said many, many centuries ago about sharing, Christian sharing, on the part of those who have more than enough. You are not making a gift of your possessions to the poor person. You are handing over to him what is his. For what has been given in common for the use of all, you have arrogated to yourself. That's a different attitude toward private property than we have in the West. I think Ambrose believed that it was a biblical view, that private property rights are relative, not absolute. You have a right. We have a right to a certain level of God's bounty. But beyond that, if others are in need, we do not have a right to continue to claim it for frivolous and extraneous purposes. Well, so much for the biblical theology of enough. Is there a new value base emerging in our society? I think there is. And I want to turn to that now. And it has some theological stuff behind it, but it is not expressed in a theological language. There was in the, I think, August 77 issue of the Futurist magazine, the publication of the World Future Society, which is not a religious organization at all, but people concerned about the future. There was a whole issue devoted to the voluntary simplicity movement. What it is, what are the implications of it for economics, what are the implications of it for the rich-poor gap in the world. I have adapted some of the material in that issue in a chart, which is over here. I'm sorry that the majority of you can't see it, so I'm going to read through it with you. But it's there, and if you want to copy it down later, because I'm going to rush through it, you may come up and do so. It seeks to contrast two sets of values. The industrial consumption worldview of the past 200 years, approximately, which has shaped all of us in this room, and what they call an emerging worldview, which is material sufficiency. Not material denial, but material sufficiency. Okay, they've got four value premises and then a list of social characteristics that fit those two sets of values, those two worldviews. And each one relates across the sheet to its twin, to its counterpart on the other side. Value premises of the industrial consumption worldview. First, that material growth, underline, growth, is the highest good. That's the way you address justice needs within the society. Let the pie get bigger. Let the benefits trickle down to the poor. And growth, after all, is the way we keep everybody employed, right? We don't buy enough this year, somebody's out of work. So growth itself is seen as a positive good. The counterpart premise over here is that material sufficiency, coupled with growth in the psycho-spiritual realm, is the highest good, or is a high good. Second one, humanity subduing nature. We've talked about that quite a bit earlier this week. Over here, humanity within nature, or humanity in harmony with nature, or humanity as part of nature. Not pulling rank on nature, but as part of, living in a kind of harmony. Third value premise, competitive individualism. I'll make mine even if I have to climb over you to do it. Economic achievement basically in the West has been through individual ascent, not through collective ascent. Value premise over here, still individualism, but cooperative individualism. More emphasis on cooperation than on competition. Value premise in the industrial consumption view, acquisition and ownership are at the center. Value premise over here, stewardship is at the center. In stewardship, you don't own, you manage, you are trustee for. Okay, what social characteristics flow out of those two? The technology in the industrial consumption worldview is what you might call, in shorthand form, space age technology. Very high, sophisticated technology. Over here, the I guess it's a catchphrase now, thanks to Schumacher and others, the technology is an appropriate or intermediate technology. And intermediate technology puts more emphasis on using human labor instead of using fossil fuels and high technology machinery. We could argue about whether that is fitting also for the West, the industrial societies, or if that's just for the developing countries. But the developing countries certainly are looking at this. And probably it, Schumacher would say it's for us to look at too, to revise downward, to de-technologize or de-develop some of our highly sophisticated technology. A second social characteristic, one's identity is in the quantity of one's consumption. Now, we would say, no, that's not where my identity is. But for our society as a whole, and I think it rubs off on us too, a great deal of the measure of our worth, our value, is in how much we consume, how much we are able to consume, and how conspicuous that consumption is. Think of our motor vehicles, not only cars, but snowmobiles, and power everything, our boats, our recreation vehicles, our the number of homes we have, the size of home we have. There has been a pretty healthy, sizable emphasis on the quantity of consumption as the measure of one's worth in our culture. Social characteristic over here would be identity through inner and interpersonal discovery. I think that has some problems with it too. Not that this is all good and this is all bad, but the authors are suggesting that this is the emerging set of values and social characteristics that may in fact replace this set. At least they're now in competition with one another. A third social characteristic is that in the industrial consumption world, there is centralization of regulation and control at the level of the nation state, the national level. In the material sufficiency worldview, there's much more emphasis on local self-determination, coupled with the emerging of some global institutions. Global institutions to manage food, for example. There is emerging a world food security system. Still very fragile, but it is being put in place piece by piece. There may emerge a world, some think we need, a world system or a global institution that can manage energy to meet the needs of the whole planet. Social characteristic on the left, goods are mass-produced, quickly obsolete, standardized. In fact, the obsolescence is the word. The obsolescence is part of the necessity in order to have economic growth. Things have to wear out quickly so that we'll buy more and keep people employed. In a limitless world, that's okay. But in a world where there are limits, maybe a new social characteristic would be marked by handcrafted goods that are durable, that last longer, and that are unique because they're individually crafted. Probably more expensive, too, in initial purchase. But over the life of the item, maybe not, because they are more durable. In foreign relations, the social characteristic here is the lifeboat ethic. We've got to protect what we have against them. And if some have to drown in the meantime, okay, we can't put them all in our boat, because there isn't room for everybody to live as we live. There isn't room on the liner, the luxury liner, for everybody to live in first-class compartment. Okay, you know the lifeboat ethic approach. It is an attempt to form an ethic. It is not an anti-ethical rationale. It is an attempt to be ethical. There's another way, another metaphor for talking about it, and that's what they put over here, the spaceship Earth ethic. We're all already in the lifeboat together, for good or ill. And we had better work out the distribution of resources within that spaceship. High pressure rat race existence over here, casual relaxed existence over here. Some would say that's laziness or an inappropriate attitude toward work, the work ethic. Well, whatever. Seven, material existence separated from the realm of the spirit. It's been basically true in Western culture that there's a separation between the material and the spiritual. Here, an attempt to balance and interplay the material with the spiritual. Finally, a cultural homogeneity here, limited acceptance of diversity, and on this side, a cultural heterogeneity, eager acceptance of diversity. Well, if you want to have more of the detail of that, it's in the Futurist magazine, August 77, with a great deal of additional material. We can come back, I hope we will, and talk about that and see whether you think that's an accurate reflection of what's going on. Let me move quickly to two other parts. The voluntary simplicity movement itself as a social phenomenon. I have a concern about it because I think for those who are really into it, it is the answer. And that's dangerous. I think it can become for some people a substitute for political action. And Jürgen Lissner, in his list of 10 reasons, says in the first paragraph that simpler living should not be entered into as a substitute for political action. It has to be combined with political action, with citizenship responsibility, with changing structures and systems if you really want to help those who have less. I think another problem with it is that it becomes often a new piety, a simpler than thou kind of life. Look how simply I'm living. And all kinds of imposed guilt on those who aren't living that simply. I think simpler living is great, but should be entered into for its own reward. And Listener's List tries to say that, and so does John Taylor in his book. It is not a heavy trip. It is an upbeat kind of liberating thing, which means it will be a happier life for you, a less consumptive life. And not as an ought, therefore not as a new methodism or a new piety. And it also, I think, too much is expected of it by some people. They think in itself it will bring about a direct change in the rich-poor relationship, and of course it will not. Your doing without a hamburger a week will not put meat or any other kind of food into the mouths of the hungry. You've got to do something else in addition to not consuming. You have to do other things to ensure that what you don't consume gets to those who need it, either through voluntary sharing or through making political changes. If you don't put fertilizer on your lawn or your golf course, that doesn't get fertilizer to the land of Indians or Mexicans, where the fertilizer may be needed to grow food. Yeah?
Quick interjection. But by a simpler lifestyle and such, it then enables a lot of time and energy that could be, that is, would be spent on a more abundant lifestyle, then that time and energy is available for helping other people.
Yeah, I think that's true, although a simpler lifestyle also is very often a more complicated schedule. It is not simpler doesn't equal more convenient. Simpler equals less convenient. Because a lot of what we buy with our present pattern of consumption is other people doing some of our work for us. Preparing our food halfway so we don't have to cook it from scratch, that kind of thing. Walking or biking instead of riding the car to buy $5 worth of groceries or whatever. Somebody has said the most inefficient use of fossil fuel energy that the world has ever devised is what it happens when one person gets into a 2-ton automobile to drive 1 mile to a market to buy 20 pounds of groceries. But that's the most inefficient use of fossil fuel energy that could ever be imagined. But of course, we all do that regularly. Well, but if you choose to walk or take public transportation or ride a bike, it's going to take more time. Yeah.
The other thing I think is important to remember is that you're not going to work for social change if it's inconsistent with the way you live.
Yeah. That's one of the points in Listener's List, that you are not likely to support political changes toward greater justice, 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, or mandatory return of throwaway containers, that kind of thing. You won't support that politically unless you're also willing in your own lifestyle to make those adjustments. If it's too inconvenient for you to take bottles back, you're probably not going to support that kind of legislation. How many of you come from states which have mandatory deposit, which are designed to help persuade us to bring the container back? Okay, just a minority. I live in a state which has tried 3 sessions in a row to get that through, and it's been blocked. State of Minnesota, which has an image of being fairly progressive in these areas, We have not gotten that through. It's come close, but it's been opposed by labor unions, primarily led by the people who work in the beverage industry, who say, you're talking about our jobs. And of course you are. But they've been joined by members of other unions in opposing the legislation on the grounds that to achieve a kind of a vague social good, as they put it, you're going to throw some people who are in immediate jobs out of work. Well, see, the society has, you never do just one thing, as Larry said yesterday. The society has to deal with those ramifications of the changes that we seek to legislate. But I agree with Mary, unless you're willing to support in your own style of life the implication of the legislation, what it will lead to, you aren't really prepared to support the legislation that we probably need in many of these areas. Let me say something about the strengths and refer to listeners' list, which is really a 10-point documentation of the strengths or positive reasons for entering into simpler living as he sees it. It's a powerful challenge to the inherited values, to the column on the left. Just the act of living more simply by those who have the income to live as everybody else does. It is a witness. I think it helps others to question and to begin changing their own presuppositions about consumption. It is certainly a vanguard for living with the reductions that will come involuntarily. And I think for most of us, a more simplified lifestyle is going to come involuntarily. It's going to be done to us, not through us, not by us. We need some people who can be a vanguard voluntarily for that, and who can be out there on the frontier and say, hey folks, it's not so bad. You can make it, you can survive. You can accept a reduction in standard of living or quantity of consumption and probably be happier and healthier. Okay, finally, I think it has been proved by those who've done it that you almost have to have a support community. You don't do it alone very effectively. One nuclear family trying to live more simply has a very difficult time. But if entered into as a community project with your neighbors, with some members from your local church, however that community is formed, it can not only be more successful, it can also be a strong community builder, a strong builder of community. And I remember the old farming days in Iowa again, where we shared threshing machines and how that built community among the farmers. And we'd have a 3 or 4 week ring from one farm to the next where everybody would pitch in and one of the farmers would own a threshing machine, not everybody. Well, there are urban examples of that today where people share aluminum extension ladders or power lawnmowers or those tools and pieces of equipment that you don't use every day. John and Mary Schramm talk about an experience, was it in Washington with the waffle iron, where one newlywed couple said in a group out of a single worshiping community, hey, how often do you folks have waffles? And the consensus was 3 or 4 times a year. And they said, well, we're about to buy a waffle iron, but we've decided we don't need to buy one if we can borrow yours. And you know, do we all have to have a waffle iron? Well, they decided that unless there were real waffle freaks around, not everybody had to have a waffle iron. But we've gotten the idea in middle-class America that every household has to have everything, has to have one of everything, and that sharing is somehow demeaning, that it shows that we aren't totally self-sufficient. And I confess to having that feeling with my own neighbors. Borrowing from them, and then the reciprocal offering them what we have, is sort of socially unacceptable. What's the matter? Are you too poor to have your own? It runs counter to the accepted value system, which says every nuclear family is totally self-sufficient in material things. Well, there may be a new way that's healthier and more responsible that we can model. Let me conclude with some comments on what the challenge to the church is in all of this. I think there will be some despair as the involuntary simplification of lifestyle, reduction of consumption, comes. And the church will be called to minister in the midst of that. After the dream has ended, after the party is over, after the third world gets its way, I think it will, at least in part, we will be paying higher prices for less. in the, for the sake of more justice in distribution of global resources. What is the good news that the church offers, or the gospel offers, in the midst of that, when most Americans will be hearing only bad news and will be, in fact, feeling betrayal by God the Bountiful? Didn't God promise that we would have ever more material abundance? Well, no, God didn't promise that. But a lot of Americans believe that, and they think it's part of the American experience as the people of God in this country. It goes with the gospel of wealth that Myron was talking about last week. Many Americans think the gospel of material success is the same as the gospel. Okay, the church will need to figure out how to minister in the midst of that, and I think it's time now to start talking about that. Secondly, the church shares some complicity as an institution in the injustices of the past and the present, and will need to confess that involvement. The church, too, has been into a kind of success, as human beings measure it, material success psychology. The church growth movement that's now on and that we've talked about some this week, the building of huge cathedrals, not just to glorify God, but also to attract human beings, the, some would say, wasteful use of resources in the church's institutional life, there's need for confession there. Finally, and I think this is probably the most important of all, the church can not only say but do certain things. The church can make symbolic acts of another way of living. These are more than symbols, but the symbols and the witness of symbols are central and are very important. Some examples. How do we as the church institutionally conserve resources in our institutional stewardship? I was in Northern California a few years ago when there was a severe water shortage, and people were talking about their local church's stewardship of water, as was being practiced in homes and everywhere else at that time. How do we conserve energy and water and use our buildings? And what kind of food service do we model? Things like that. Well, churches are starting to look at such issues as part of their stewardship. Holden Village is, certainly. I think the church also can model a support community style for those who are seeking to change their consumption patterns. And there are some examples of that around in just ordinary middle-class suburban-type congregations. By the way, I don't think you preach the message of simpler living to the poor in America. Poor in America already understand something about simpler living. You preach it to the non-poor. At least you start there.
I don't know.
Well, okay, let's hold that. I'm almost finished and we can come back to that. I don't think the rich preach it to the poor. I think that's kind of offensive. Finally, the church's own behavior as a corporate entity in a world of big institutions. Are we just another big institution, or do we model another way? Can we model ways of behaving institutionally that are not entirely self-serving? Can we vote our stocks, for example? And all the churches have stocks, the denominations. Can we vote those stocks with criteria that include, in addition to return on investment, the social impact? Well, some of the denominations are starting to get into that. It's very controversial, partly because you never know the result. It's ambiguous. But we are looking at that, social responsibility and investment, which may mean some lessening of the return. It has implications for our pension plan and many other things the church does. Well, I've got a few other things here, but let me stop because the time's almost up, and you want to say something about to whom the message of simpler living should go.
I was just thinking of that, and from my background growing up in Texas, I kind of take an image of poor. It's not fair, but I think of a lot of the black and the Mexican American, and I think of the welfare system. All these things enter into it, but I especially remember going through the barrios of some of the slums and seeing the broken down houses and everything falling apart, and up front is a shiny Lincoln.
Yeah, you question their priorities,
yeah,
how they're spending what they have.
We do need to preach to them, too, that, you know, they're a lot of times trying to reach up to our level, and when they do have a sufficiency there, but aren't satisfied with it. They aren't satisfied with it, and are just trying to figure out more ways of getting things.
Assessment of what's going on there is that at least partly it is an emulation of the conspicuous consumption of the rich.
Right.
You consume in ways that show that you're you're not totally in abject poverty. You can have a television set, antenna shows, and a big car. So, you know, where was it picked up? I suppose it was picked up by the behavior from the behavior of the rich. So I would say that the lifestyle change that the rich might think the poor have to adopt should also follow the pattern of the rich. I mean, the willingness of the rich to show that they can do without.
Okay.
Yeah. Harold?
I was going to say that same thing and also say that it's really a global phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
To go into some third world countries, mm-hmm. and really poor, and see people living without indoor plumbing and without any of the sort of necessary amenities for health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And with children who are obviously malnourished, but yet have managed somehow to get a big stereo.
Yeah.
In there. Yeah. It shows the extent to which
the
value system has permeated even the most.
It also reflects the successfulness of Western-style advertising in some of those countries, the consumer goods that are pushed. And I suppose the most dramatic example of that is the sale and the pushing of infant formula as a symbol of Western success, modernization, symbol of being sophisticated. That's the way it's being advertised. And even when mother's milk is entirely adequate and much less expensive. I wonder if any of you would like to take up or take issue with the social characteristics or value premises of this chart. They're generalizations, of course. How do you feel about that? Is that what, in fact, is going on?
I haven't had a chance to study them, but it seems to me that there is some inconsistency and that it does not necessarily have to be divided that way. I think it seems to me I see some bias and prejudice in the division.
Yeah, the authors, I'm sure, were people who favored the second column. I mean, there's no doubt about that. They say that very clearly, that they not only think this second column is emerging, but they hope it's emerging. Yeah.
And it certainly doesn't rule out many of those things from being in the other column.
Mm-hmm.
The other comment I'd like to make is in connection with the lifestyle. I think there is tremendous confusion there, and we have many misconceptions about it. Because, for example, here in the state of Washington, we have quite a number of places where people have moved into who are going to live the simpler life. There are two counties particularly where this has happened. In one county, I can't give you the figures offhand, but the people have moved in, going to live off the land, and the number of PhDs and people with master's degrees who have moved in there, it would really surprise you. But it would also surprise you probably how big a proportion of those people are presently on welfare.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And they maintain they are satisfied with their contribution to society. It's unbelievable. It's incomprehensible. It's simply... I can't understand it. People who have ability and capabilities that will allow themselves to not make a contribution when they can. They have been educated at the expense of society. What is their contribution? They're satisfied with it. They maintain they are.
Yeah. I don't know how large that phenomenon is.
It's
think
much
the
larger. It's been so high in the state of Washington. Two counties have simply almost going bankrupt. They've had to get some help to maintain.
They were low population counties that couldn't take that burden, you're saying.
They were
big counties.
Counties where there are mountain valley over here, another one way over here, and to build roads and services in there, and it simply bankrupted the county.
I think it would be wrong to assume that the Simple Living movement is about rural communes alone. I think it's primarily about middle class people with jobs living in cities or wherever they live who are trying to reduce their consumption.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. Much of the so-called Simple Living movement, people think of it as identified with much of the counterculture movement. And much of the counterculture movement has some of those same characteristics, but there were people who were the last people who were equipped from their background to manage a simpler life. Yeah. But that is not the majority population of the simple living movement.
The thing that I wanted to point out too was that really the change that through simplicity can come from people like us right here who can simplify our life.
Yeah, well, that's what I was addressing this morning.
We can do it because we are in a viable position.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That in itself has a tremendous influence.
Yeah.
But people who do the other thing are no longer viable. They're,
yeah.
they're a liability.
We have some options that we can choose because
that's
we are viable economically. That,
but
I guess, relates to the poor, too. Very often the poor don't have that room.
My mm-hmm. point was that there is a tremendous misunderstanding here and a tremendous feeling of support and tremendous, well, a sense of that's the way to go. And it isn't the way to go. It's a way to go to ruin.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah, I think for some, simple living means giving up some of your income. For others, it means not giving up any of your income, but using your income in other ways, in more responsible ways, sharing more of it. Ron Sider, in his book, talks about a graduated tithe and a responsible level of income for an urban family in a Western society. And he says it comes out for him and his family at about $8,000, $9,000 a year for a family of four. They can live on that. If they have income that is double that, that frees half of their income to do other things with. And they can support all kinds of good things they want to support. So you can consume less in order to share more. The bell rang. If you want to copy these down, I'll leave it up for a day or so. Thank you.